Oh, the fourth debate's in Ohio. Claire, are we going to go?
It depends on what city in Ohio it is. I'm not going to Cincinnati.
You want to take bets? I bet it's Columbus.
I bet it's Columbus, too.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. I hope everyone had a nice Labor Day, and I hope anybody dealing with the aftermath of or preparation for Hurricane Dorian is staying safe. Since the last time we gathered, the stage for the third Democratic primary debate has been set. There's only one debate and just 10 candidates participating. So we're going to discuss whether that means the field has been winnowed down to 10 and what the dynamic of the debate will be now that there's only one night of action. And here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
I'd say it's going pretty well. How about you, Galen?
It's going well. Going pretty well. Also here with us is senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
Good to hear.
For the first day of fall, it's going pretty well.
Pretty well.
The cultural first day of fall.
And also here with us, of course, is managing editor Micah Cohen. How's your fall going so far?
Well.
Good. And real quick before we get started, I wanted to mention that 538 is hiring two reporter positions. So one is someone to cover the intersection of politics and race with an eye toward the 2020 election. And the other is to cover the intersection of politics and tech. And you can read the descriptions of those jobs on our site at 538.com/jobs. Guys, is there anything else you want to mention about those jobs other than encouraging people to apply?
No, these are really important beats, and for different reasons, stuff we feel like we have not always been as strong on as we need to as a newsroom. And there are also beats where we expect to get candidates, some who are kind of coming from a more conventional journalism background, some maybe not. So, you know, if you know people who'd be good for these jobs, we think we are a great place for data journalists and regular journalists and people who have skills that could make them become journalists and everything else. So please direct them our way.
All right. Fantastic. 538.com/jobs is that website. And we're going to get into the topic that I mentioned. But first, let's ask our favorite question, which is good use of polling or bad use of polling. Last week, Monmouth released a national poll showing basically a three-way tie between Biden, Sanders, and Warren. Warren and Sanders were at 20 with Biden at 19% support. But that's just one poll. Those candidates are not actually tied in the average of polls, where Biden still leads the other two by about 10 points or more. In any case, the Monmouth poll got plenty of coverage in the press and plenty of backlash from the Biden camp. Some Biden-aligned folks even suggested the Monmouth poll should not have been published at all. So let's clear this up. Is it a good or bad use of polling to publish an outlier, and why, Nate?
Well, okay, this is kind of a loaded question because it presumes that we know what an outlier is ahead of time, which we don't.
No, so what is an outlier?
An outlier is a poll that diverges from the consensus, in my view, because of sampling error. People would define it differently. So what I mean is, like, inevitably, as a result of the fact that you're surveying a subsection of the population, the margin of error on polls is higher than you'd think, especially this Monmouth poll, which surveyed, I think, 298 Democrats. And even that margin of error only covers 95% of cases. So if you're dealing with literally dozens or hundreds of polls over an election campaign, you're going to have some weird polls. However, it is absolutely a pollster's job to publish the data that it produces as a result of the methodology it did ahead of time. A pollster should not be saying, oh, I don't like what that poll said. I'm afraid I might get teased on Twitter. I better not publish that poll. No, that's bad. And there are concrete consequences of that, one of which is that sometimes polls will miss real movement in a race, and they'll say, okay, well, I wouldn't publish a poll showing that, right? And therefore, you're suppressing polls that actually would have gotten the result right. So there are seven of this, for example, in the Australian federal election earlier this year, where a lot of polls, like literally every poll, had like Labor with a U.
Thank you for clarifying. Labor Day with a U is May 1st, by the way.
So Labor was like 1 or 2 points ahead in like all the polls. They all said the exact same thing, which should have been a sign ahead of time that there was what we call herding, which means pollsters are trying to not stick out. They're trying to not look bad. Moo. Guys herding. Moo.
Bah.
It's all bah.
Yeah, isn't it bah?
Well, I think you can have a herd of cow or sheep.
I was trying to herd.
A mixed herd.
What about cats?
Cats are impossible to herd.
You can't herd cats?
I mean, this is all metaphor.
Pollsters should be more like cats.
What's
don't
a group,
herd.
What's a group of cats called? Isn't it something crazy?
A ca- a cackle of cats.
A kettle of cats.
Continue, sorry.
Anyway, the point is that, like, pollsters... The whole point of, like...
I just Googled cat plural.
Uh-oh.
And this is the point at which this podcast turns into cat memes.
What is the plural of cat? Cats.
What do you call a group of cats?
Yeah, that's a better Google.
It's called a clowder.
A clowder.
There's also, I think it's a murder of crows.
Whoa.
Yeah.
A clowder of cats? What's a group of journalists?
A shit show.
Drunk.
A wine.
What's a group of pandas called?
An embarrassment.
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Are you serious?
I was looking at it.
An embarrassment of pandas?
I used to have a book when I was little that was all about names of groups of animals.
Yeah.
So while we are in the mindset of defining things, can I just clarify exactly what we mean then by an outlier? Are you saying that this Monmouth poll is not actually an outlier?
It is an outlier, but outliers aren't bad. They're going to happen naturally as a result of having sampling error. And it means that you're not putting your finger on your scale. That means you're being honest. If a pollster publishes a weird result, then you know it's being honest, right? So in the long run, number one, yeah, sometimes you're surprised. Sometimes a poll that you think is an outlier turns out to be the new normal, right? People like us, I mean, we have methods and we can probably give you the rough odds that something is an outlier or not. But it's like not really a pollster's job to do that. A pollster's job is to actually represent public opinion and not make a lot of assumptions about it.
Here's, from a practical effect, here's where political Twitter gets hairy, right? Which is that people follow a lot of people from certain political campaigns or certain political parties, and it is in the interest of those campaigns to trumpet certain polls and downplay other ones. So, for instance, like last week I was out on the trail with like following Biden around, and like so people were kind of like when Monmouth released the statement, everyone was kind of like, oh, yeah, like, shame, or whatever, you know, like, don't pay attention to that. But the whole reason why people were paying attention to begin with is because it was good for other people for whom it is advantageous to promote that single poll. So what it comes down to is that you should not be taking your opinion of the race based on a single poll. It shouldn't be like a
no, of course. And when you do, and there's a piece I have on the website this morning, it's about like, okay, when is the time when you might be really excited about the new poll? Well, it's after something happens. After the debate next week, then the first polls we see will be exciting because we should no longer necessarily have the prior if a bunch of stuff happened in the debate that things are the same, right? But look, some campaigns are much better or worse about litigating individual polls than others. So of the big three leading Democratic candidates, the Sanders and Biden campaigns are much more annoying about litigating individual polls and sometimes their supporters than Warren, who like never says anything about individual polls because that's a sucker's bet, right?
Well, and she also just is kind of anti-poll because she advertises she doesn't
publicly
have that internal pollster
pretentious branding,
yeah,
right?
That's BS.
But the point is, like, if you're a campaign and you're like getting really excited about individual poll, like, first of all, God, quit being so short term. It's September. We finally had Labor Day. There's still a long way to go until anyone actually votes, right? And we'll tell you that polls actually do have some predictive power at this stage. But like, you don't have to win the freaking news, the meta news cycle about the poll, right? Just chill the F out, campaigns, right?
Although, so my sense is, though, that it was not just the campaigns. The media in general sees this three-way race poll and is like, oh my goodness, look, it's a three-way race.
But,
like, this is exciting.
But again,
let's cover this.
Yeah, that goes to like, Politico and everyone else writes like single poll stories, or not everyone else. A lot of places write single poll stories. It gets people excited on Twitter to see the update or breaking or new poll, like siren symbol things. And it's like, who's up, who's down. That gives people juice along the way to push the narrative. And yes, it's totally like a media problem and people should take those stories with a grain of salt.
Yeah, actually, I was proud to see our colleagues at ABC News did not write a story off the single poll. But like in general, there are very, very few exceptions. You should not be writing a story based on one poll about the horse race. The exceptions to that are like in the last couple days of the campaign, maybe.
Even then, there are lots of polls. The only time you should write a story off one poll is when there's a big news event and it's the first poll.
And it's
out.
The first poll. But like, honestly, maybe this was naive of me. I kind of thought we were past this. I thought people had kind of learned this lesson. It's weird.
One of the ironies is like, this is more likely to happen in slow news cycles. I mean, there was not a lot happening. We had a week-long news cycle about Bret Stephens, which I'll refrain from commenting about further. But, like, it was a news week. And, like, the irony is that when you have a slow news week, nothing's actually happening. The poll is more likely to be an outlier because nothing's happening. So, like, that's when people kind of get really excited about polls that clearly don't. But, yeah, I mean, look, in one of the reasons 538 was founded was to just avoid these annoying news cycles by having people look at a polling average. We don't have our average of the primary up yet, but that probably tell you that, like, hey, you don't want to be too aggressive in August about adjusting your expectations in the race. I'm referring to when this poll came out.
So good use of polling in terms of releasing the poll and the outlier, even though it's an outlier. Bad use of polling for all the people who wrote like single poll stories off of it. What did you guys think of the statement, though, Patrick Murray released about it? Basically saying, hey, this is an out. We know this is an outlier.
And that's Patrick Murray of Monmouth saying, we decided to release this poll understanding that it was an outlier in response to all of the, you know, campaign blowback and media coverage.
It was like somewhat apologetic in tone, though, which seemed a little weird to me.
I understand why he did it, because there is a lot of attention on polls. People don't understand them, right? Like, people don't understand what an outlier is. They might think that, all right, we can't trust the next poll, right? So I think he is doing a little bit of like reputational work where he's saying, yes, we understand this is a thing. We release all our data. I don't know. It's if it's transparency about the process.
No, I think
it makes sense.
No, I totally agree. It was just like, look,
so we wrote a big piece this morning, which is meant to, first of all, Monmouth is an A-plus pollster. So this piece kind of it's like a defense, among other things, of this poll and the decision to release this poll, which I think is unambiguously like the sign of good, honest, high-quality work, right? There are a couple of things I could say, one of which is a lot of times these universities, just like when the media releases polls, will have a write-up and will send people on TV, and so they will be part of this cycle about talking about this poll as though it's the only kind of poll that matters, right? And although it's newsworthy. You know, the other thing is, like, this is a poll where the sample of Democrats is 298 people, and I get that, like, doing high-quality polling is expensive these days. There's not quite like a hard and fast line in the sand where it's like you go from meaningful to meaningless, right? I do think, though, that when you have lots of other people releasing polls of that consist of 800 people or 1,000 people, or Morning Consult has a panel that's tens of thousands of people, literally. I do think if your poll is 298 people in that race, then like whenever you differ from the consensus, then it's probably because of sample size issues. The difference would be like, let's say you're polling an obscure House race where I have no prior whatsoever about what's going on there. A 298-person poll is pretty useful there. It's not that precise or even halfway to that precise, but it's better than my random-ass guess, right? So I'm not sure if, like, everyone else is issuing these big, more robust polls and it makes sense to, like, focus your efforts there. I would rather have him – it's not my polling institute, right? I'd rather have him go back to Nevada or poll – like North Carolina or like a state that's important on Super Tuesday that hasn't gotten polled much or something like that.
Actually, if you look at the Monmouth results, which showed like Biden, Sanders, Warren in a three-way tie, were very much an outlier, as we've said. Almost every poll shows Biden with a clear lead. But actually, the YouGov polling is not quite a three-way tie, but is closer to showing that.
Here we get into the difference between outlier polls and House effects, right? Yeah. So clearly, YouGov has something that has been good for Elizabeth Warren. I think that like what it might be is that...
Sorry, Nate. Yeah. Just I should say the last YouGov poll had Biden at 24, Warren at 20, and Sanders at 14.
Yeah, and they've consistently had Warren like at 20 instead of 16 or something. Why is that? I think it's probably because they are either deliberately or unintentionally getting like a more educated kind of college-educated panel, maybe because they figure people are more likely to actually vote, maybe because like there is bias in who responds to an online survey. But for some reason, Warren does bounce around a lot from poll to poll based on the methodology, whereas Sanders and Biden tend to be steadier. But yeah, YouGov is like has been friendly for Warren. So that's a different category than what I would call an outlier. That's what we call a house effect, meaning persistent leaning or bias. You can say in a statistical sense bias doesn't mean that YouGov is in the tank for Elizabeth Warren. It just means there's like a statistical bias in the sense of a measure diverges from the average in a consistent way toward Warren in their case.
All right. So in conclusion, we have good use of polling by Monmouth, bad use of polling by, you know, some media outlets and some of the campaigns. And you know, we'll do this more as we see coverage of outlier polls that maybe doesn't make sense and try to put them in context.
We'll cover polls we'll for cover the rest polls. Of the campaign.
We will. We'll do it. But anyway, let's move on and talk about the debate lineup. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. Simplify the morning and evening now with a simpler electric toothbrush from Quip. Timed sonic vibrations cover the basics of every part of your mouth and just take 2 minutes twice a day. The mirror mount puts brushing front and center in your bathroom, so you'll remember to bookend the day using your new brush. And the lightweight, compact design means you can bring it along with you on those last summer weekend getaways. So enjoy sleeping in and then ease back into the swing of things with a smile. Quip has sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums. Oftentimes, people brush too hard, and some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive. There's also a built-in 2-minute timer that pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and help you clean your whole mouth evenly. Up to 90% of us don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That is getquip, getquip.com/538, the numbers, not the letters, getquip.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every part of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/538. That's netsuite.com/538, the numbers, not the letters, to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/538. We're back, and the lineup for the third Democratic primary debate is officially set. There is a single debate on Thursday, September 12th, hosted by ABC in Houston. The candidates are Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris, Yang, Buttigieg, Booker, O'Rourke, Castro, and Klobuchar. So first off, is it fair to say that the field has now been winnowed down to 10 candidates, Claire?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are obviously more than 10 candidates, but I think the people who have realistic polling and funding numbers enough to make the debate are probably the people from whom a nominee will emerge. It's the clouder.
A clouder of candidates
from which the nominee will likely emerge.
So are we done hearing from the other people? What do they do now? No. Oh, okay.
Thanks to the internet and America's rapacious appetite for all things presidential, I'm sure we'll keep on hearing from quite a few of them. And some of them have a lot of money, right? So, sure, we'll keep on hearing from them.
I mean, some of them could also reemerge in this October debate.
Yeah, which has the same thresholds as the September debate.
And you're allowed to use the polls since the last debate in order to qualify.
Yeah, so Tom Steyer, you know, you have to feel bad when a billionaire is not able to buy his way into the debate by spending tens of millions of dollars on Facebook ads for
it's pretty biased
for a $1... It's absolutely accurate characterization.
Fair enough.
So, but fortunately, there are more opportunities for Tom Steyer to get polls, and he has 3 of the 4 he needed. He just missed by 1. And
Steyer to get higher.
So Steyer's going to get higher, guys.
Yeah, Steyer and Gabbard.
And Gabbard is 2.
Yeah, seem like the most likely of the candidates outside the 10 to make this debate to make the next one. It's weird to me, though, that the qualification period for the next one includes pre-September debate polls. Right?
Maybe they're just afraid of winnowing too much. Like, if you only then
have 10 candidates left. Like, okay, let's be really literal about this and say, okay, the field has now been winnowed to the 10 candidates who made the September debate. Even on that stage, you're going to have candidates who poll regularly at 1%, 2%, 3%. So it's like you sort of already have all the levels of. It's not like it's just a debate between Biden, Sanders, and Warren, right? You have multiple tiers even within those 10 candidates, including a low tier of people who, like, you could argue maybe even shouldn't be in the race anymore.
does having one debate change how impactful the debate will be for Democratic voters?
What do you mean?
How much it could affect the race overall, people's perceptions of the candidates. I guess there's only one event to focus on instead of maybe a second event that then eclipses the first event. Should we consider this any differently from the first two debates in which it was two nights and 20 candidates?
My guess would be yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a huge difference, but my guess is that having only one event will sort of concentrate focus on that event. And therefore, if anything happens, will maybe marginally, but somewhat kind of magnify the results.
Also, we've already had in total, four nights of seeing all these people answer questions. There are certain things that are kind of already out there. So maybe it takes it to, I don't know what kind of place it takes it to. Does it make people less engaged watching the debate because they say, listen, I watched this show already two times?
See, I think it's more engaged because now it's like
fewer people.
It's like a new season of the show.
Well, what I think will make this particular one-night debate very interesting is the fact that Warren and Biden will be on the same stage, and they are two people who have sort of decades-long ideological animosity towards one another, and they are both doing quite well.
And they haven't been on the same stage.
And they haven't been on the same stage yet. And I think that they are two charismatic in their own way candidates. And I think that that will produce probably a very interesting... I think people will be interested in that.
What are the points of tension that exist between the two of them in particular?
Well, Warren has clashed with Biden sort of famously. Her biggest, you know, early clash with him was over this bankruptcy bill in the late 90s, early 2000s. Biden was obviously a senator from Delaware. Delaware has a lot of financial interests, you know, companies that are headquartered there. People sort of were saying Biden was a bit more pro-industry. And Warren obviously is a bankruptcy expert, wrote a book about how American middle-class families were sort of being screwed by the system. And they had very different views on a bill, and you can very easily go back and find news articles and TV clips of Warren and Biden going after each other. She is a Senate witness. He is a member of the body, obviously, and they just have very different views. And Warren, if you read her memoir, her sort of, you know, a few years ago running for office memoir, calls out Biden and says, you know, basically, she has this line where she says he can't pretend to be a friend to women on some things, but not be a financial friend to them, right? You know, the idea that women and working women were being hurt by these financial rules and that Biden was ignoring them. So they have very deep-seated animosity toward one another, and I'm very interested to see how that displays itself.
Has it come out on this campaign so far?
I do not think it has risen to popular culture attention. There's certainly been stuff written about it and people obviously know about it, but I don't think beyond people thinking like, oh, well, Biden's kind of like old guard Democrat and Warren is a new progressive. I don't necessarily think people know the depth and length of the animosity they have towards one another, at least from a political point of view.
Yeah, I think this campaign, it's mostly been limited to like somewhat passive aggressive comments by campaign operatives on each side, right?
Right.
It's like you haven't really seen the candidates genuinely and kind of explicitly go after each other.
Is it in their interest to do so now? Is now the time to start that?
I mean, for Warren, I think it's unclear because, you know, one part of her might think, hey, like, I just have to contrast myself with Biden by being on the same stage with him and appearing more kind of, I mean, I think she has been the first two debates a better debater, quote unquote. I'm not sure that it hugely serves Democratic purposes to like attack him on policy from the left, unless you have to kind of prove your bona fides to the left.
But we've already seen a lot of that in the primary thus far.
Well, like, I don't think it's worked.
Wait, fair. This has actually been quite a more contentious primary than 2016 in a substantive way, because, I mean, you saw Castro, Booker, Harris going after the Obama administration, right? Not just Biden, the Obama administration during the last debate. To me, it's like, why would it stop in the next debate? And yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit. Like, is some of that stuff going to hurt Democrats in the general election? Yeah, maybe. But to me, it seems to be the kind of climate of the Democratic primary is to be contentious.
Right, and especially maybe more for people like Castro, who either make a name for themselves being bold in these debates
I think it's also major party candidates. I mean, major contenders. I mean, I think Harris's campaign has been pretty aggressive in general about this.
Well, but Harris, I think. Warren right now is on a good trajectory where there are reasons the Warren campaign kind of maybe doesn't want to do anything big because things are going pretty well for them. Harris maybe needs another course correction. Biden, I don't know what Biden's incentives are.
Incentives for what?
In terms of like
attacking people.
Is Biden going to go after Warren and Bernie and whomever else for being too left?
I don't think he does. I think he goes after them for like, well, they're being impractical. I mean, he has this whole line in his stump speech where he says, it's an implicit dig at Harris, where he says, at least Bernie's being honest about how much Medicare will be. To me, some of that is, it's a dig at Harris, A, but B, it's sort of a friendly gesture towards Sanders, with whom he shares a lot of voter support, actually. Like, we've talked about this. If you look at the first and second pick for a lot of voters, Sanders and Biden kind of share a class of voters, maybe because they have a certain, like,
je ne sais quoi.
I don't know. Yeah. Or appeal to a person who might be a populist voter or something. And you might not think of Biden as a populist, but I think he has some strains of that. I mean, these are also people, right? So, like, Biden might just go after Warren because
he gets annoyed.
And she might go after him for the same reason.
Well, the other interesting thing about what might be different this time is a lot of the more moderate candidates have now dropped out.
Or been winnowed.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like when your parents put down your dog. Yeah. You've been widowed.
Pivoted to video.
It's like it's very black.
Delaney made a pivot to video.
If we have to do layoffs, yeah. A winnowing of the staff.
But here's the difference, though. I'm sorry, Micah. I haven't even talked that much this episode.
No, I just want to finish that point.
Okay.
In previous debates, we saw a defense of moderation somewhat from Biden. But that defense was actually, I thought, made more forcefully and more effectively from like Hickenlooper and
Bullock. Delaney.
Exactly right. Delaney had the Delaney surge that Claire predicted, remember? Where now it's really just going to be kind of Biden carrying that
Klobuchar
torch. Klobuchar and Biden maybe are the two that kind of Buttigieg and O'Rourke maybe could get in a little bit. But anyway, the kind of moderate standard has fewer bearers.
But Beto has been running to the left. Yeah. He's been trying to out-woke
reset
everybody and reset. Buttigieg, I think, might make more of a play. But here's the thing I was trying to say earlier. the difference, I think, between Warren... I mean, first of all, I think she should obviously hit him on the bankruptcy stuff. She has expertise there. It's consistent with her philosophy or brand, if you want to put it more cynically, right? So that seems like a obvious thing, right? I don't know, though, overall, because voters do, and we can debate whether this is a correct perception or not. I tend to think it probably is. Voters perceive that if you're more toward the center, you're more electable. Electability is Biden's big advantage, right? So when Biden is telling Bernie, hey, look, you're way too far to the left, this stuff isn't realistic, and we're not going to beat Trump running on socialism, right? Like, voters might buy that, actually.
And do you expect him to make the same argument towards Warren?
Yeah. I think he probably intends to kind of lump them together.
So we've considered the Biden dynamic here. In the most recent debate, actually, Warren and Sanders were on the same stage, and they seemed pretty friendly. In fact, I think Warren at one point said, you know, I'm with Sanders when it comes to Medicare for All. Is there any reason to change that dynamic between the two of them at this point? Do they continue to be friendly towards each other?
I think yes, because I actually think Warren doesn't necessarily view Sanders as a full-on threat.
Why is that?
I think, well...
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of bold.
It is a bold statement.
No, I kind of agree with
that. I think, like, she probably views electoral competition from Harris and Biden the most because she's trying to win over people who are only with Biden because they think he's the most electable but might share her political views. And Harris is the other kind of party progressive, although Harris is painting a more pragmatist stance. And Sanders has been a bit, he's obviously polling well in the race, but he hasn't seen the same kind of movement that she has upwards. He's kind of there, like, you know, frozen at a certain number. So I don't think she needs to go after him.
What about the reverse? Does he want to try to take Warren's progressive supporters and go after her?
I mean, she has more reason to feel good about her staying in the polls than he does, because she seems to be, obviously has more momentum. We can debate how meaningful that is, right? But, like, seems to be doing better in Iowa, maybe most importantly. Seems to be doing better with, like, highly informed voters and so-called likely voters. And there's a theory, like Claire was talking about earlier, that maybe Sanders just going to get his 15 or 16%. And, yeah, probably of that 15 or 16%, maybe 4 or 5 of that percent can be peeled off. But the rest are pretty hardy Sanders backers, because he commands a lot of loyalty from people. Yeah. And, like, and the easier part of his coalition to pick off, he already picked off, like, remember, he got 2% of the vote in 2016, right? And so she's already picked off some of that as of other candidates. And so the question is, like, let's say both Sanders and Biden are stuck, that Sanders is going to get 15 to 20% and Biden's going to get 30-ish percent, right? Can she get enough from the rest to, like, win states? I mean, maybe. There's maybe enough, but that means you have to actually make sure that Harris doesn't get in there with very much of it. Buttigieg doesn't get in there with very much of it.
What about looking at this from Sanders' perspective, knowing that he's gotten 42% support in the past? What is his strategy going into something like this to try to win that support back?
If Sanders wants to really win this nomination, shouldn't he go after Warren?
I mean, I think the whole way Sanders going about the campaign's been a little backward, where he was trying to run on, like, electability, which I thought was strange, right? And has still been very combative, not always the candidate, but certainly, like, the campaign. You know, I kind of thought the way to run the campaign was, like, as a, I've said this before, I think on this podcast, as a kinder, gentler Bernie, where, like, I am the new standard bearer of the party and the party's ideas. It's a little tricky, though. I think Bernie's a fairly good debater, but, like, if he's like, hey, I'm the original gangster and Elizabeth Warren is stealing my leftist thunder, like, that's going to come across as not particularly well, I don't think.
You would say he should be, in an ideal world, the Sanders campaign would be making the ideological argument that he's the OG, you should vote for him, not Warren, but do it in a kind way.
They have shifted to that. They have shifted to focusing more on healthcare.
What's funny to me is that, like, if you were running for president, you would definitely run the salty, combative campaign and not the, like, nice campaign.
This is a kindler, gentler Nate Silver, folks.
I mean, if I wanted to win, none of this is strategic necessarily. But, like, but they have shifted toward going after Trump more and running more like, hey, we were the originators of Medicare for All, and that's a really important policy. And so I think they've been smarter recently. But, I mean, again, I don't think it's easy for Sanders to win, in part because there are alternatives to him that are younger and he has this age question, and, like, for the time being, electability works in his favor. I'm not sure it will in the long term.
Can Sanders win states with Warren polling at 16, 17, 18, 20%?
Because Warren has had this kind of long, gentle upswing in the polls, right? She's gotten news cycles where if you're kind of bullish on her, then you always look smarter 2 weeks later. That's not always true, though. I mean, almost inevitably, she will have one, if not multiple, periods where the narrative shifts and there's more scrutiny on her. I think I'd rather be at 17 nationally with momentum than 17 nationally, which is Bernie without momentum, with sideways or maybe slightly down. We can debate whether it's moving up or down, but flat mostly. But, you know, I would say that you don't want to get too cute there. And that it's hard to predict that whether momentum in the past necessarily means future momentum. There's probably some reason to think that. But yeah, maybe Warren has another round of scrutiny over the Native American thing, which is a big problem for her earlier. Maybe she's bad in a debate. I mean, we all were sitting here before the second debate being like, oh, well, you know, Kamala Harris is such a great debater, right? It's all upside for her. You know, what if expectations are really high for Warren and she falls very flat in a debate? Because we're not talking about a huge sample. We're talking about two debates where she was good. I thought she was good. But two is like, not really enough to know that, oh, she's a great debater, and, like, people like us are hyping up now how the debate's an opportunity for her.
As we wrap this part of the podcast up, we've talked plenty about the three leaders in the polls. Is there an argument that this should be considered a three-way race at this point? And if not, who should we be paying attention to amongst the other seven on stage?
I think that's a really bad view of the race, and I think it's like a living room view of the race, or like a Twitter-only view of the race.
That there are three.
I think that there are, let's expand it out. Maybe there aren't 10, but maybe there are 5 or 6 really viable contenders. And there are, you know, obviously Iowa and New Hampshire are first. They have a certain kind of white, more activist-y kind of voter. But there are ways for candidates to surprise in those primaries. There are ways for people who don't do well in Iowa and New Hampshire to pick up a lot of votes in the primaries that come after that. And I also just think that it's a broken record refrain, but it is really early. It's the cultural start of end of summer and beginning of fall, and people are sort of like snapping back into things. And I do still think that there's a lot of stuff that can happen. People are still opening up field offices in states. People are, you know, there are, I think, still probably, maybe not 10, but probably 5 or 6 people for whom, you know, crazier things have happened.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah, I agree. Would anybody be really surprised if, like, let's say Buttigieg won Iowa? Would that be shocking?
No.
No. It'd be a surprise.
No. I don't think it'd be shocking. Yeah.
It wouldn't be shocking.
What if Yang won Iowa?
Shocking.
That would be shocking.
Well, if he won after polling at like 2% in Iowa, but we would probably have some sense that
he would go up in the polls. But like even then, I was just looking at the 2012 Republican primary polls. On January 1st, 2012, a gentleman by the name of Rick Santorum was at 4% in a Real Clear Politics average.
Nationally or in Iowa?
Nationally.
Okay.
Right. Of course, what happens then?
He won Iowa.
Well, he's sort of like, he did win Iowa, but he kind of wasn't declared the winner on election night.
But he didn't win the campaign. So, this is the thing, right? Is there a fairly good chance that, like, Buttigieg or Booker or
Nate's getting his talking.
Tulsi Gabbard, I don't know.
I haven't gotten to talk a lot.
I'm going to speak more slowly.
No, yeah, you have to take up more time.
You take up more time.
No, okay, so, yeah.
But they can surge and still lose. It's like when a team comes back and ties the game in the fourth quarter, and they lose in overtime. It's still a freaking loss. So anyway.
But what's your view on how big the field is, right? Like, we've spent a lot of time talking about the top three, but, you know, how big is it in reality, would you say, the top tier?
Let's go around the panel. The chance that someone other than Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, or Bernie Sanders wins the nomination is higher or lower than 35%?
I reject the premise, actually. In all seriousness, I think this conversation about, okay, how should we define the field shouldn't be defined by who can win or who will win. It's just who's going to do well, who's going to be like a presence in the race. And so in that sense, Santorum.
Wait, what kind of standard is that? Like, do we remember the person's name 5 years from now that they ran for president? I don't understand.
Okay, so if I ask you about the 2012 Republican primary, who was in the top tier in that race?
Romney, Santorum, Gingrich.
Scott Walker.
Perry for a period of time.
16. Walker was 2016.
Was that Huntsman that year?
Oh my God, it was.
Huntsman was there that year. Ron Paul was there. But the point is, Ron Paul actually is a perfect example. He was never going to win that race, but he affected the race, right? Or even Santorum. I don't think, maybe there was a couple points where it seemed like Santorum could win, but not really. But he was a real factor in the race.
So you're saying there are influencers in the race who do not have a chance of winning, but they are influencers nonetheless, and that they should be considered as part of the top tier of contenders because they are ideologically influential, if not likely to be given the nomination.
Yeah, let's use Buttigieg. I'm not saying this is true, but let's just imagine some deity came down and whispered in her ear and said, "Hey, I built a model of the Democratic primary, and Buttigieg has
what a weird-ass deity."
Buttigieg has.
What if God was one of us?
Buttigieg, yeah, I'd be like, "Hey, you want to break for 5:38?"
Actually, God will be filling the new reporter roles.
Buttigieg has a 70% chance of winning Iowa, but only a 0.1 chance of winning the nomination. I would argue here for still including Buttigieg in the top tier.
Okay, that's also like a pretty weird
you never know,
world.
Yeah. Not really.
So, but what is the role that Buttigieg is playing?
Exactly. That is the question I think we should be asking. That's what matters.
So what is the role that the candidates who are influencers but not likely victors, what is the role that they're playing? They are influencing
the vote, the conversation, okay. You know, the things that everyone at this table will be obsessed with over the coming months, which is why I think it's important to include them in our conception of the tiers. If you limit it only to like who has the best chance of winning, I think you'll leave a lot out.
You're saying it's that the top three might be the top three, but they exist in a presidential candidate biosphere that is heavily influenced by like four people specifically who will never be president or the nominee, but who create the presidential biosphere.
I mean, doesn't that sound just like a way, Micah, for the elite press like us to like insert our biases into the race and say, oh, here's who we think America should
hear
from.
But isn't some of this like polling, based on polling, which is...
Well, maybe American English should be more based on polling. I mean, the problem is it can be like a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy where you get more media coverage, you poll better, you get more media coverage. It's a self, you know, reinforcing cycle. At the same time, you know, Kamala Harris kind of her bubble popped and you've had people like Buttigieg and Yang who kind of emerged from obscurity into semi-obscurity.
Wait, but like, can I just even ask a question on that? Like, who said Kamala Harris's bubble popped? Didn't the media say that, Nate? And aren't you just parroting what the media is saying?
I mean, and the people have actually been in denial about the fact that, like, what the hell happened? She upped to, like, 15%. Now she's down to, like, 7%. What happened there? There are all these takes on, oh, you know, all these Biden gaffes or Bernie gaffes or whatever, right? And she's the one who saw her support go from something to half of something within the span of a few weeks. You know, what's going on with that campaign? And I think the media's been pretty forgiving to that. I guarantee you, if Biden were to fall to the high single digits, right, there would be no shortage of think pieces or Bernie or Warren even.
I mean, Harris and Buttigieg kind of had – Harris had a more accelerated version of kind of what happened to Buttigieg, right?
Maybe that does kind of reinforce the notion that like, okay, so there was some stuff going wrong along early on where there were some Biden and Sanders voters that were name recognition based, so they both got fairly big bounces when they entered. But if you ignore that entry bounce – then they've been pretty consistent with Sanders in the mid to high teens and Biden at 30-ish percent, right? Maybe those are kind of locked in. I'm not sure about it, but like it's not a crazy theory. And therefore, that 45% of the vote's off the table and everyone else is fighting for the remaining 55%. And so as Warren kind of begins to get the plurality of that 55%, then she takes away from Harris and Buttigieg. I don't know.
And you know what that could mean? Contested convention.
Okay, Galen.
Too early? Too early?
I think the odds of a contested convention have gone down as you have had these three or four kind of major candidates emerge. And as you have had kind of people not... You get a contested convention when you have constituents divided like pretty much in several different ways, right? I mean, first of all, so Bernie at 15%-ish, 17% the RCP average, is not that high above the threshold where you have to get 15% in a state or district to get delegates, so therefore he's kind of flirting with that, and that would not be super robust. So if you have the primaries right now, then it would be Biden and Warren and Sanders would be the only ones who would get delegates, but they're also below 15% in some states, so Biden would get the lion's share of the delegates, and you would not have a contested convention. You'd have Biden winning, probably, until they get consistently in the 20s and not the mid to high teens.
All right. Well, this has turned from a conversation about debate dynamics into kind of an overview of the race at this point in time, which I think is probably valuable and also will be reflected on the debate stage next week. So I'm glad we got to do that. But anyway, I think that is a wrap for now. So thank you so much, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
And thank you, Micah.
Nate, did he get enough in by the end? Enough talking time in by the end of the show?
I feel like I did pretty well in the second half. Yeah. Recovering from a week.
Negative first, splits.
Weak first half.
Who had the best first half? I think I had a good first half, bad second half.
That's too meta. We can't do that. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. And again, go check out those jobs we mentioned earlier in the show at 538.com/jobs. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.